And welcome to another edition of the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z. We're so happy. The Natural Nurse, Ellen Camai, has the week off, and we're so happy to bring you this real cutting-edge information on health, wellness, and naturopathic medicine. I'm so happy to be here and to have our guest, Bevan Clare, on. We'll talk about her. But remember, you can always get more information about our trips to Jamaica, our eco tours for cures, our tropical ethnobotanical journeys to Jamaica, where we take people on a sojourn to learn about herbal medicine of the Caribbean at ecotoursforcures.com. And of course, our websites, naturalnurse.com and drznaturally.com. I'm Dr. Z. I'm a naturopathic physician. I'm the founder of the University of Bridgeport College of Naturopathic Medicine. And I'm also the chair of the Botanical Medicine Department and steward of the Medicinal Herb Garden. So it's a great meeting of the minds to meet Bevan Clare, maybe not in person, but digitally here. And she's a professor at Maryland University of Integrative Health. And the program director of the MS in Clinical Herbal Medicine. She holds MSc in Infectious Disease from London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and has studied herbal medicine around the world, blending her knowledge of traditional use of plants, like the real use of traditional medicine, with modern science and contemporary healthcare strategies. Today, we're going to be talking about her book, Spice Apothecary. What a lovely book it is. It's so picturesque and beautiful. The pictures just jump out at you. Real eye candy. It's amazing. And she enjoys interacting with her students online as she wanders the globe with her two kids. And she's the current president of the American Herbalist Guild. Of course, I'm also a professional registered herbalist since 1990 with them. And at the American Herbalist Guild, she works to promote clinical herbalism, accessibility, and professionalism. Her website, Bevan, Bevin Clare, Clare.com, and on Facebook and Instagram at spice.herb.wanderer. Bevan, it's great to have you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Yes, so excited to talk about your book and your wanderings and your lust for herbal medicine. I was reading some interesting articles about looking at antioxidants. I had a patient with a very high oxidative LDL. And for those that don't know what that is, it's sort of like the, LDL is kind of like your bad cholesterol, and even badder is the oxidative LDL. That's the one that does a lot of damage to your arteries. And amongst my readings, I found out that one of the most powerful antioxidants are the polyphenols found in allspice, Jamaican allspice, which we do gather a lot when we're on our trip to Jamaica, our eco tours for cures. We should bring some of your students down there, Bevan. And
I'm sure they love that.
I'll share with you some good pictures of our websites and things like that. But I found that that and allspice were the highest in antioxidants, and they came from spices. Spices are really amazing, and I could see why you chose it for the topic of your book, but maybe you have your own reasons.
I mean, I could talk all day about all of the different things that brought me to spices, underestimated elements of our diet. And I think partially that's because no one's going to get rich quick off of selling spices because they're just ubiquitous. I mean, we already have them. We can use them without even buying anything a lot of the time. But the famed Mediterranean diet that everyone talks about, and when they cite it, they always say, oh, olive oil and fish and vegetables, but they forget the absolute abundance of spices that is ever present in the Mediterranean diet, and how incredibly healthful they are. So, to that point of antioxidants, all spices are good spices, and they're just They're just wonderful things. I mean, they really don't have any negative points to them, other than that they don't last forever necessarily.
You know, you mentioned in the first chapter that our senses are attuned to taste, touch, and smell. People have used them for flavorings, of course. Preserving food is a big thing, and particularly in places where there's not a lot of refrigeration, and valued cultural totems. And even though we have the synthetic flavors, we return again and again to spices for foods and medicine. So there's a lot of history with spices. We you know, hear about, you know, the Spice Islands and the West Indies, and just so many different stories about spices through the history of medicine. Tell us a little bit about some of them that you talk about in your book.
Yeah, and spices have been some of the most valuable things that exist. And it's hard today to even imagine. But when our, you know, as you say, they're useful for food preservation and so on, and they're abundant in the tropical regions of the world. But as you leave the tropical regions and you get to, you know, you still get some spices, particularly in the Mediterranean regions. But the further north you go, the further treasured they are. And I think it's almost impossible to imagine if you had a diet of local food in, let's say, Northern Europe, and that was your diet, what it would be like without those spices and flavors to never have even tasted those. So when someone comes along with a little vanilla or a little cinnamon, you know, you can imagine that. And that's one of the things that I love about them. I mean, you know, they are true sensory medicine. And one of the things that drew me to spices is that, you know, I have this thought all the time when I go to the grocery store, and whether that's, you know, a natural oriented grocery store or a conventional grocery store, none of them smell like food. I mean, you walk into this building that is full of food, of tens of thousands of different kinds of food, and you smell and there's just nothing. And that always strikes me, because food is such a sensory experience, and it's one of the things that I love about it. But it really strikes me with herbs. I mean, you go to the herb section, and again, typically there's no scent of herbs, but yet you go to other places in the world and you go to markets where people would buy food. You go to places where people would buy spices and herbs, and it's overwhelming. I mean, the scent just absolutely bowls you over. And I love that about herbs and spices, that they do have these qualities that we can experience, that we can enjoy, that can transport us. And with our spices as medicine, we have the ability to do that by adding those things into our food, by using them, and by, you know, evoking flavors and places and memories. And so, you know, that is one of the big reasons why I like to use spices as medicine. And I find, you know, frankly, people ask all the time, so what herbs do you take every day? And unless there's something particular that's going on that I'm really focusing on, most of them are spices. That's mostly how I would use herbs every day, not in, you know, quaffing back a whole bowl of capsules. In, you know, for wellness, spices can do so much.
Yeah. Interesting story. I live in Connecticut. That's where I'm kind of broadcasting from today. And they call it the nutmeg state, which of course is based on the idea that nutmeg was such a valuable spice to the colonists that people would actually whittle fake nutmegs and then mix them with a couple of real nutmegs and then sell it to some person and then, you know, run the other way with a nice pocket full of change. And then by the time the person got to the bottom, they'd find out that they had a couple of fake nutmegs. So that's why they called it the nutmeg state or the nutmeggers. So,
I love that. I'm going to use that someday. That's fantastic.
Real spice story from the great state of Connecticut where I hail from. So yeah, that's there's so many, like you said, there's spices from East Asia, cinnamon, and what's galanga? I've heard of it, but maybe the listeners haven't heard of galanga. That's an interesting spice.
Yeah, that's common in particularly like in Southeast Asian cuisines and places where you know, I think that it has a pretty jarring flavor. Like it's for in places where people are used to an abundance of strong flavors in their foods. And I think that one of the things that amazes me always about particularly like Thai cuisine and some of the cuisines of Southeast Asia is that they tend to balance all those flavors. They have sweet, sour, salty, pungent, bitter, spicy, you know, they have all of these things together. And Galangal brings like a very kind of interesting, moving energy. It's not really even spicy as much as it's just incredibly strong. And it's related to ginger. So it's a really interesting spice if you get a chance to try it in a blend of things. And you might even recognize it from Thai curries that you might have had or so on. I don't know a lot about its medicinal use. And I think that's one of the fascinating things about spices, right? Is that they all have medicinal use and there's so many uses of them all, but there may not be a lot of evidence-based literature out there about them.
Yeah. Although, like you said, a lot of the spices are well studied. I developed a product with the Natural Nurse for, you know, inflammation and autoimmune disease. And it's it has 50 to 1 rosemary. Like, we potentize it so much because of the rosmarinic acid, which actually comes from all the different, many of the Laminaceae family plants. But it's very, we found that rosmarinic acid is a very strong, it kills abnormal T cells and leaves the normal populations of T cells alone. So in autoimmune disease, we find that like some of the T cells get programmed. They first start off as like little naive T cells that don't know anything. And then they get programmed to, you know, kill, crush, destroy the particular organ, whether it's collagen and arthritis and lupus or the thyroid and Hashimoto's. They do that. And then if you use the rosmarinic acid, it seems to, you know, take out these abnormal T cells without affecting the population of T cells that you, you know, get if you took methotrexate or some drug like that. So we found that it's part of a holistic approach to autoimmunity from rosmarinic acid. So
You
know, it's kind of interesting.
Sometimes those simplest things, right? I mean, they have such power in them and such incredible medicine. I think that a lot with cinnamon. You know, it's so underestimated, but phenomenal as a medicine.
Yeah, cinnamon is so much, so powerful. Although, tell us about cinnamon, because I know when we go on our Jamaica trips, there's a cinnamon tree, but then there's also like a bush that they get cinnamon from, which is a cassia tree, which is a little bit different. So I think cinnamon comes from this cassia type, and then it also comes from cinnamonium species, you know, and they both have cinnamon, but I heard that the one from the cassia is not as good for us. Did you come across any of that in your research?
Yeah, so there's when we talk about cinnamon, we're actually talking about a lot of different species and two different genera of plants, the cinnamomums and the cassias. I love all of them, and I have to say I love them enough that my daughter is named Cassia after cinnamon. Cinnamomum was a little weird to name her, so we went with that one. So when we're talking, all of them are medicinal. They all have medicinal effect, and they all help to support a healthy blood sugar balance. And in both, you know, healthy individuals and pre-diabetic in diabetic individuals. But the it's the true cinnamon that you want, which is more the Asian and Vietnamese cinnamon, the Cinnamomum verum or Cinnamomum xylanicum. And a lot of times you can see this marketed out there as it'll be either true cinnamon or cinnamon verum or Ceylon cinnamon or Vietnamese cinnamon. And you can buy them pretty regularly. If it just says cinnamon, cassia tends to be less expensive as cinnamon and can vary dramatically in its flavor. So some of the most cinnamony cinnamons, like the ones that when you think of smelling cinnamon buns are that's a cassia smell, but then some of them are also very mild. However, they do have reasonably high levels of coumarins, all the cassia species of varying levels of coumarins. So they can be not great long-term as far as, you know, interacting with blood clotting factors and so on. So fine in food, absolutely, and fine in food-based doses. But if you're looking to take cinnamon consistently long-term, particularly if you're helping to support your blood sugar balance, then you just want to make sure you're getting the right cinnamon. That said, you don't have to go out and buy like an encapsulated cinnamon product. You can still use actual cinnamon. And in Spice Apothecary, I talk a lot about how to actually prepare it so that you get a consistent amount every day in certain preparations. However, you can just add it to your smoothies or your oatmeal or whatever it is that you're eating. That's a really easy one to use, and most people are so familiar with it.
Yeah, people, you know, love spices. Should they vary their spices, you know, to get different types of spices in their diet, or should they, because, you know, I was going to say consult their healthcare practitioner. They probably don't know anything about it unless they're you know, a herbalist or a naturopathic physician who at least has some training in botanicals. What are your favorite spices?
Oh, wow. I really like them all. I mean, garlic has to come out on top because it's just, it's phenomenal.
Your pesto recipe was, I tried it already. It's really
good. All right. What did you put in it?
I liked your take that you could put other greens in. Mm-hmm. So besides using the basil, I added nettle leaves when to give it that really good phytotherapeutic nutritional punch because of the great nutritional value of nettle leaves. So I kind of blanched the nettle leaves to get the stingers out of them. And then I, you know, pureed it with the, we used almonds, like you suggested in your book, although I guess you could use pine nuts, and quite a bit of garlic and good quality olive oil. And I used the fake cheese because I'm allergic to cheese. So I used a vegan Parmesan. And what else did we throw in there? A little sea salt, I think. Boy, I tell you, it was fabulous. And we froze it in ice cubes, so we have it now for a long time. So that was a great recipe from your book that I think people can really enjoy.
Yeah, there's very few rules when making pesto. I mean, you have to have the greens, you have to have the olive oil, and but even, you know, I think part of it comes from sometimes there just isn't enough basil. You know, I want to have an abundance of basil. I don't want to go out and buy it, especially because it tends to be sold in fairly small quantities, in my version of small quantities, even those plants that they sell that have a bunch of stalks. But some things such as parsley are incredibly inexpensive. And if you grow them, they tend to be very abundant. But at the grocery store, you can even buy a sizable bunch for less than a dollar often. And you can make parsley pesto. Absolutely. I make a parsley pistachio lemon zest pesto that's really wonderful. And that's dairy free also. So there's so many different possibilities to make it. And that's a great way to get a lot of spices in and to get to try them. So I love garlic and pesto. I think garlic is just fascinating to me also physiologically and how it works. And I think really relevant right now in these times where we're thinking so much about our respiratory health and our respiratory system. You know, I grew up with a family that loved garlic, and people used to always talk about, you know, how your breath smells like garlic after you eat it, which of course we all experience that. But I never really realized that what is actually happening. I think as a child, I thought, okay, well, you put garlic in your stomach and then it like comes out of your stomach and it comes onto your breath. And really looking later on and realizing that actually, you know, your respiratory cells are actually exuding garlic. I mean, your whole body smells like garlic when you eat garlic, but it's essentially like a shield for your respiratory system. You know, those same cells that are the places that viruses and so on are taken into cells and into your body is the same place where garlic is right there as a defense. So it moves through your body so well. And if you, you know, if you haven't ever done this trick before, if listeners haven't ever been bored enough to try this, if you take a clove of garlic and you cut it open and you rub it on the bottom of your foot, usually in like the slightly more tender parts, but garlic can be a little hot. So you rub it on there and in about 10 minutes, you'll taste it in your mouth. And that's a pretty phenomenal way to just see how some of these spices move in our bodies. And that's one of the things that really makes me think about spices is that, you know, we have these long-term relationships with these plants. Our bodies know exactly what to do with them. And there's some fascinating research around about this, especially around when people are pregnant and they consume spices, that the amniotic fluid actually tastes of those spices. And that's one of the reasons why babies who are born to parents that, let's say, eat a traditional cultural diet, like if you're a baby that your parents are of Indian descent and or you live in India and you're eating all of those curry flavors and so on, you're born liking those flavors. I mean, breast milk tastes like that. Amniotic fluid tastes like that. You are just ready to go with these different flavors. And I did that. I tried to do that with my kids. And I, you know, that was a really intentional thing. And, you know, it could be lucky, but they both grew up absolutely loving the flavors of garlic and spices and always, you know, seeking those on their food ever since they were babies.
Wow. That's just amazing research. Wow. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. You know, garlic has a lot of sulfur in it, and sulfur is needed for, you know, strength of our connective tissue, you know, chondroitin sulfate, glucosamine sulfate. You need that sulfur to kind of build the proteoglycans, which is kind of like the gelatinous matrix that gives our cells, well, our connective tissue plump and our joints plump, you know, kind of like that shock absorbing capability. And then, of course, we as herbalists and naturopathic physicians respect sulfur as a major part of the livers and kidneys, by the way. We always say the liver, but we always diss the kidneys. They're detoxification systems. Five of the seven pathways in the liver, the second pathways, the phase two pathways, sulfur in some way drives those, whether it's sulfoxidation or taurine conjugation or glutathione conjugation, all of it requires sulfur. So it's nice to hear, you know, I'll often prescribe when someone comes back low in sulfur, like I run their labs and I find that they need sulfur, I'll tell them to eat sulfur-containing spices, like cilantro is a good one. Can you make a pesto out of cilantro, or is it too strong, you think?
I mean, it would be horrible for somebody who hated cilantro, but if you like it, then yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's a great one to make a pesto out of. And I think it could be good combined with even different things because it does have such a strong flavor, but that what a great thing to make a pesto out of cilantro. And you could even, you know, add up some mashed avocado in there and so on. And it could be a whole nother new thing.
You know, an interesting story.
Brilliant idea.
We had a lady that had very high mercury levels. You know, we tested her both urine and hair and nails. You know, you can actually send your nail clippings to the lab and they'll actually look at it that way. So we really documented that she indeed had elevated mercury. She wanted to pull the mercury out of her body very nature cure way. She didn't want to use pills or other things like that. So that's what we gave her. We gave her lots of recipes with cilantro, and we had her come to the University of Bridgeport, the naturopathic college that I run, and we put her in the sauna. And wow, over a year, we were able to really document her mercury levels go way down to normal just through cilantro. Now, she did, I think, four bunches of cilantro per week.
Wow.
And saunas, at least three saunas, 45 minutes IR sauna. and then, you know, a dry brushing to move the lymphatic system. But yeah, I mean, just with spices and a little sweating. And by the way, that's an interesting segue to some of the spices that make us sweat and move the blood. Is there any, I mean, that sounds kind of like a very folklorish concept, but I know there's a lot of evidence that, you know, some spices can really help move our blood. And so why would that be important to a herbalist to move someone's blood that's stagnant?
Yeah, what a great thing to bring in, because I think, you know, as you say, it's important to herbalists because we do use these kind of energetic concepts of the body. And, you know, a nice example of this for listeners to understand, if you're not familiar with energetics, is the idea, if you think about constipation. So we're all familiar with what that means. And yet it can come from all different causes. So let's say you have somebody who runs really hot and really dry energetically. They're always kind of parched, overheated. They might even have a little bit of a temper, you know, quick movements and so on. They might be constipated because their stools or their bowels dry out because of the heat and the overall dryness. And then you might have somebody who's also constipated who is cool and damp, and they get kind of a sluggish, bloated overall situation because things just aren't moving. They tend to be more fleshy and they retain water and things just don't move around so much. So there's, you know, an example of two completely the same condition that would have the same conventional diagnosis. Oh, you are, you know, you have constipation, but yet you need to work with them very differently. And so when you talk about things that are moving, that kind of sluggish, more damp person that doesn't have a lot of movement, spices, you know, hot spices or things that are more moving could be really helpful. And it's the same for menstrual cycles, you know, people who menstruate, who get really, you know, bloated and feel like everything is just not moving and very stuck ahead of time. That can be helpful, even supporting a healthy heart. A lot of these things that are helping to move blood can even help with metabolism and even feelings of fullness. I mean, some of the cool research with cayenne, I think, is fascinating, where, you know, and with a lot of spices, is that people, they stop eating earlier and, you know, as far as how much they're eating, and they feel full much faster with a lower quantity of food if they're eating spices. And that's not just because of the flavor, because even if they actually encapsulate those spices and have you take it with your meal, people also stop eating a little earlier on. So that, you know, those are pretty fascinating ways that the body interacts with these spices.
You know, the number one over-the-counter drugs now are probably stuff for digestion. You know, you read different statistics, but pretty much, I think that's true. A lot of spices can be used to stimulate the digestive tract and stop gas and bloating. I'm thinking of all those wonderful spices that are what we call carminatives. What are those, and how can they get people off the proton pump inhibitors and the Tums and the Mylanta and all of these things that people drive to the drugstores to consume all the time?
Right. Yeah. Digestive things are so common. And, you know, starting with the good news, I think with a lot of these types of digestive orders, not disorders, you know, that aren't serious underlying pathologies. So if you've already been given the clear from your primary care provider and, they're saying, yeah, you know, you've got some serious indigestion or you've got this or that going on and you should take a proton pump inhibitor or chew on Tums. You know, in a way, you have the freedom to experiment, and because it's not like these are life-saving drugs for you on a day-to-day basis. So people can go ahead and often try to see if there are some natural things that will work. So carminatives are herbs and spices that help. They can help dispel gas and they can help regulate peristalsis. And so, you know, peristalsis is that that wave, that smooth muscular wave that moves through our digestive system. And that's kind of always happening, but we're really familiar with the sensation when we know we need to go have a bowel movement. So, you know, we feel that kind of movement and then it's like, oh yeah, it's time to do this. But we all know what it's like when it goes wrong. I mean, when that peristalsis, and when there's cramping and when there's a gas and there's bloating, and it's just, you know, incredibly uncomfortable. And it happens to, I think, everyone at some point or another. And when it happens, you can reach often for spices. So those carminative spices, mint is a classic, of course, but also things like ginger and cinnamon and cardamom, you know, so many of those types of spices, pumpkin pie spice. It doesn't mean you can use a pumpkin spice latte if your stomach gets upset, but there's all of those spices in there. And one of my favorite ways to use these spices, and I can tell you where you can find this recipe freely available online as well, in the Mountain Rose Herbs blog site, that I wrote a recipe about using an herb and spice compote. And so essentially you take whatever fruits you like, and I love the stone fruits like apples, peaches, pears, plums, because they are naturally high in a lot of pectin and other more complex carbohydrates that are great food for your gut flora. So a lot of times when you have this dysbiosis, your gut flora is also not happy, all of those little bugs. So it kind of feeds them. And so, you know, you cook gently with a little bit of these fruits, things like cinnamon and ginger and cloves or nutmeg or cardamom or whatever you have around that you like. And then you can eat that as like a fruit sauce. You can add it to yogurt or add it to oatmeal, and you can freeze it, like you said, in your ice cube trays, like your pesto, and use little bits. And I've seen that really help people recover from, you know, courses of antibiotics or just long-term dysbiosis.
Great. Well, we're going to take a break and play one of our natural medicine chests that myself and the natural nurse have done, our little mini modular program. When we come back, we'll be still with Bevan Claire and talking about her Spice Apothecary book. So stay with us, folks, for more.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the nutrient known as taurine.
Amino acids are chemical constituents that form the building blocks of protein in the body. The official definition of an amino acid is a compound which contains an amino group and a carboxylic acid. Taurine contains a sulfonic group instead, so is not a true amino acid, although it is often referred to as one. The intracellular concentration of taurine is 10 times that of any normal free amino acid.
Taurine was discovered in 1827, but the significance of taurine in nutrition was not realized until 1975, when the journal Science published a study showing that taurine-deficient cats suffered from retinal degeneration. In 1986, the Annual Review of Biochemistry reported that the amount of taurine present in mammalian milk depends on the species. Natural human mother's milk is rich in taurine, but cow's milk, except for the early milk known as colostrum, is taurine deficient. Pediatrics Journal in 1983 printed a study which outlined several of the biologically significant functions of taurine, and an effort was then made to fortify infant formula by adding taurine.
Some species of animals, such as cats, cannot synthesize taurine within their bodies, and so must receive it through their diet. Humans have a very limited ability to synthesize taurine, so adequate intake through diet and supplementation is important. The principal source of dietary taurine is meat of various types and shellfish. Even people ingesting sufficiently high levels of taurine may develop a deficiency due to the overgrowth of certain anaerobic intestinal microorganisms which consume taurine. Certain prescription drugs are known inhibitors of taurine uptake.
The Journal of Neurochemistry published a study in 1975 which showed that taurine concentrations are extremely high in the retina. In fact, the retina contains two binding proteins specific for taurine. Research has yet to determine exactly how taurine functions in the eye, but deficiency of taurine has been found to lead to the degeneration of photoreceptor cells. Continued studies on taurine have linked its presence to several biological functions, besides being a protector of the delicate tissues of the eye. Taurine helps to neutralize oxidizing agents caused by ionizing radiation. Taurine is present in high concentrations in the normal heart. It stimulates white blood cell motility and protects cell membranes from free radical damage. Taurine has proven useful in epileptics to reduce or control seizures. It helps modulate the transport of substances such as sodium, potassium, magnesium, copper, and iron across cell membranes. Additional research supports taurine's role in preventing gallstones.
So, as you can see, the nutrient taurine may be an important addition to your natural medicine chest.
Here with Bevan Clare, and she is the author of Spice Apothecary. We're really excited to have her back, and we'll continue our using spices to support our health goals section of the program. Now, Bevan, welcome back. And let's talk a little bit about particular health conditions. You know, we talked about like taurine with the eyes and things like that. But you can think of spices as a tonic for different systems, like the kidneys, for instance, parsley, celery, sage, and things like that. And, you know, the heart, you mentioned cinnamon and garlic and things like that, the lungs. So the spices have an affinity for certain organs?
It's such a great question. And I think they do. You know, it's not like they don't work with the whole body, but, you know, you mentioned parsley. And I think anyone who's familiar with using medicinal plants and you mentioned parsley, they're just going to think about the kidneys. And why, I'm not really sure, but, you know, it does have a lot to do with the particular phytochemicals or so on. But I think even in traditional medicine that you notice these things in your body. And if you, you know, if you're paying attention, it really becomes clear. I mean, my daughter just said to me recently, you know, whenever I eat watermelon, this is how I feel. Like, this is the sensation I feel. And I'm like, well, that's, you know, that this is because it's very, it has a relationship with your kidneys. And so we notice that with certain foods and certain spices. Now, not all of them are like that, I think, but absolutely, some of them can impact different areas of the body. And as the more and more we learn about some of these spices for health, then the more, you know, we can apply them. I think one of the things that came up, I think, since I wrote the book, which fascinated me, because I tend to look at the traditional uses of spices, and then I often increase the information by adding in justification or kind of support from current evidence base. So, you know, the book tends to be Spice Apothecary tends to be evidence informed whenever possible. But of course, if traditional people have always been using something like rosemary for cognitive effects, I'm happy to include that. But I saw a paper where some researchers took a look at cumin and weight loss. And I saw the title of it and thought, you know, if someone had reached out to me, which it does happen, and said, hey, we're going to do this study looking at patients comparing cumin and Orlistat 120 for weight loss, what do you think? I would have said, no, I don't think this is a good idea. I mean, why? Why would you do this? And yet, you know, cumin actually had comparable effects to Orlistat 120 in weight loss in a sizable population in a gold standard clinical trial. And I was fascinated by that, just thinking, you know, I would have never thought of cumin that way. I've never used cumin that way. But here we are with, you know, a new look at something that's used traditionally all over the world. And so it's fascinating to think about how these spices do have affinities for different parts of the body or different systems.
I just had a patient yesterday who has, you know, pretty bad osteoarthritis of the knee, and I was going through the literature and found out this great study done by Australian nurse practitioners using both oral and topical ginger, and they found that it was, you know, after a couple weeks, way more effective than the conventional allopathic you know, kind of first line osteoarthritis drugs like Celebrex and whatnot. Really interesting stuff. I mean, and you know, people have been doing like ginger poultices for, you know, probably millennia. I know when I was down in studying with different Jamaican maroon practitioners like Jamba, he would often take turmeric and ginger and a couple of other plants that were kind of like spices in a way, a spice in the black pepper family, which is called Piper Amalago, which the Jamaicans call pepper elder bevan, and probably grows in a lot of other places like that, a lot of these pepper kind of cousins. And boy, I tell you, this was very amazing. When I twisted my ankle down in Jamaica on a hike, really just incredible, you know, just anecdotal stuff. But, you know, these folks down in the Caribbean, like the shamans that I've studied with and travel with on my eco tours for cures with the natural nurse, you know, these guys, they never like, you know, went to college to learn about herbalism. They don't know the phytochemistry, but they know the bush. Like they always say, we know the bush. We know, you know, we observe these things, and you've traveled around the world, you know, studying ethnomedicine. Tell us about some of your travels and you know, involving spices and things that you've witnessed.
So spices have really been, or herbs and spices have really been the instigator for most of the major life choices I've made. And so I grew up always loving plants, you know, going out in the woods and making things. I had no idea what I was doing, but just making things out of the plants. I'm always fascinated because as an adult, I remember what I was playing with clearly enough that I can identify it now. So that always fascinates me. And I've loved traveling since I was a child. And I would always try to go somewhere adventurous, even you know, again, as an older child, my parents would let me pick somewhere on the globe and we'd save up our pennies literally and go adventurous places. So when I was in my teens, I studied herbal medicine quite a bit. And I also, you know, teenagers, right? So I already knew everything about herbal medicine in my mind. Not really, but this comes to be important with the next piece is that when in my later teens, I bought a one-way ticket to Southeast Asia and I had all the time in the world, but very little money. And so I found myself in really remote areas. That's what I wanted to do, is just, you know, push the boundaries of where I could go. So if someone said, you know, for a dollar, you can take a 6-hour bus ride, or for 15 cents, you can take a 4-day boat ride, I'd be like, stick me on the boat. And so, you know, I'd go on the boat. But what I didn't anticipate is that as I came to some of these really remote places, like remote parts of Myanmar, Burma, or Cambodia, or Indonesia, that when people would see a white woman walking around, they would assume that I was either a doctor or a missionary. And both of those people would have medications and access to medication because there was no hospital care, emergency care, conventional care facilities at all available mm-hmm. in a lot of the areas that I was in. So people would bring me their sick. And I was young and I was pretty terrified and it was very awkward because I, you know, just say, I'm so sorry, I'm not a doctor, I'm not any of these things. And the look of just the letdown on people's faces when I would say that I couldn't help. And yet I knew that these were places where the intact systems of herbalism that, you know, that already had all these medicinal plants. And after a while, I realized, you know, maybe this is just a conversation, you know, with these folks to try to help reinforce some of the systems of herbalism. Maybe I have a different take on some of it. And I, over time, in these travels of a couple of years, I got to see what herbal medicine was possible, what was possible with herbal medicine through people's traditional uses of herbs, through my own experimenting, also with other travelers I would meet that would be ill. And it was profound. And I think something I would never have witnessed, because in almost all of these situations, the answer should have been, if it was available and would be today, you need to go to a hospital. Like that, you know, this is where you need to be. But when there's no hospital and this is what you have, you get to see what's actually possible. And it blew my mind. And for me, that was why I came back and at university studied infectious disease, because I really believed that although herbal medicines never are as powerful as conventional antibiotics and otherwise, if you're talking about sheer muscle power, their ingenuity and their diversity of approach and creates a sustainable and often extremely healing and powerful solution to a lot of these conditions that, you know, that we still struggle with today because of resistance and building to the medicines that we have available in conventional medicine. So, you know, herbs just, you know, blow my mind, and travel helps bring me closer to them everywhere I go.
Yeah, I mean, I also have looked at a lot of that literature too, and working with some of the bush doctors. I remember once couple of interesting stories. One lady was definitely having trouble with her diabetes and getting her insulin. So we started to use as many anti-diabetic plants as we could to bring her blood sugar down. And, you know, we had the glucometer there at least as some Western technology to at least assess our the effect of the herbs and spices, and they were very effective. They at least bought her time so that she could get down to Kingston and get her prescription filled for the, you know, a different type of insulin. I forget whether it was the fast or the slow one, but yeah, I mean, the herbs worked, albeit slower than taking a shot of insulin, but they were insulinomimetic. There's no doubt about it. That blood sugar went down to normal. We averted a health disaster in that country, and I mean in that particular patient. And there was another person that had what seemed like a diverticulitis type of deal, and we were able to help that. And then my own case of why I became a naturopathic physician was I was a marine biologist studying in Jamaica, and I got sick with some dysentery, and this was before Imodium was non-prescription, and so I was like ready to go home and get treated, fly out of Jamaica. But one of the bush doctors said, well, you know, we have herbs for these types of things. Why don't you try a strong tea? And I remember they used, a lot of allspice, and they used a particular type of fern, which is, we know ferns kill parasites, right? And of course, I didn't know anything back then. I was just like, okay, let's try it. Because I kind of grew up with a little bit of an herbal tradition. And lo and behold, this decoction of guava and spices and herbs did the trick. My belly was cured, and I was like, wow, these guys never went to college. They're not doctors. They're not Western trained people. Boy, but they knew a lot. And that's what opened my eyes to studying, you know, ethnomedicine way. You know, and then I'm like, where can I learn about this more and become a physician? You know, I left marine biology. Of course, President Reagan helped me by cutting my grants too. And I decided to go to Bastyr and become a naturopathic physician, and then, you know, join the American Herbalist Guild. So yeah, we have interesting kind of stories where it involves studying with real traditional medicine people and seeing the effects and kind of changing our viewpoints. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, it's so inspiring when you realize that these things are just all around us, and you know, and And you don't have to go to the bush in remote areas to access them. And that's one of the, you know, the accessibility of these spices is one of the main reasons I wrote this book. And it was ironic. It came out. The plan was not to have it published in the beginning of a pandemic. That was not when it was supposed to be released. But at the same time, it was the perfect moment for people to be able to have a medicine apothecary right there, not have to scramble. And, you know, those early days of the pandemic, herbs and things were selling for absurd prices as everyone suddenly realized they needed to have these things. And yet a lot of people, we had a lot of it. It was just right there in our spice cabinet.
Right, right. I mean, there's a lot of herbs people can grow, whether, you know, depending upon where they live, of course. But certainly people should have some type of herbs growing in their garden and certainly purchase them. So where could, you know, where do people get pretty good quality herbs so that they can have them in their apothecary? And what do you think are the kind of the essentials that people should have in their, you know, as we say in our book, the natural medicine chest?
Yeah. Well, the book lists 19 of the most common spices. Mm-hmm. And, they really are the most common. They're ones that pretty much every listener would have heard of. And I think you don't have to have all 19 of them. And where you get them, it's a little bit like food for me, where there's, you know, good, better, best. So all spices are good. You know, it doesn't matter where you get them if you can actually have them. Now, if you have the money to get things that are, you know, organic, or if there's things that are fresh, or if you have the funds to be able to refresh what's in your spice cabinet a little bit more frequently, if you're not going through and using things, then that's a nice thing to do. And it's easy. Some spices last a really long time, you know, things like powder ginger probably last forever. But if you go into your spice cabinet and you look, especially the leafy spices, and you just look at them and smell them. I mean, do they look vibrant? Do they smell vibrant? Do they have a lot of flavor? If not, it may be time to replace them and start with something fresh. And so you can get them at the grocery store and so on, but they can actually be more expensive to get there than ordering them from a spice purveyor you really like, such as Mountain Rose Herbs, or Penzies has a lot of wonderful single spices. They also have a lot of blends. And as a busy working parent, I really love all the blends. I love blending spices too, but I don't always have time to take, you know, 15 or 20 different things out and mix them all together and put them all away. So having all of these possible spice blends that can be used is a favorite. And that's one of the ways I like to actually use spices medicinally, is to make custom blends, or to have people make custom blends for themselves. And the book, I have blends for immune health or for cognitive health. And you can just use those freely in whatever you're cooking or making, wherever you want. And I should also add that a lot of times, quote, ethnic grocery stores, if you have like an Asian or Latin American grocery store or a larger grocery store that serves people that are eating foods that are traditionally eaten all over the world, you can often find much more affordable spices and oftentimes even better quality spices, because people that are buying them there are, you know, really know often what they're looking for. And although the quantities can sometimes be a little extreme, because they're for people who are using a lot of spices. So you might have to up your spice game, split it with a friend, or, you know, even just give it away as gifts or so on. Spices are wonderful gifts for people.
Yeah, that's true. There's some stores that are more in the urban sections in Connecticut that tend to have really great spices that I've kind of purveyed and stop by. And you know, I've also tried your booming breakfast recipe.
Ah.
I'm like, you know, it's good to maybe do some things that maybe wake you up and, you know, kind of make you a little less dull in the morning. So that's, you know, I use tofu and your cognitive blend. And, you know, then I sauteed all the things and I use my more vegan cheese. And boy, that was great too. So there's, you know, in your book, there's a lot of great recipes that you share. I love that. And just great colors, beautiful pictures of the herbs. I got a kudos to the photographer that took a lot of these pictures. If it was you, amazing.
No.
Okay. They just laid out all these great spices. I mean, I love books like this for, you know, that are useful and they're great on your coffee table, you know. And I actually started, I think I left my eggplant in the oven, but I roasted some of the eggplant and I'm going to try the garlic and I'm going to use the non-dairy yogurt. But that looks good too, to make like a baba ganoush type of recipe, you know, as a nice dip or hummus things. You have great good dressing recipes, how to make dressing without having to buy all this, you know, chemical based dressings. I really love your book there, Bevan. It's just amazing.
Thank you. A lot of the idea with the recipes are not, I mean, we can all find recipes for things out there. There's tons of those. But the idea is to translate the idea that you hear you should be taking a certain spice. You know, you go see your naturopath or whoever you see, and they say, yeah, you know, cinnamon could be really good for you, or you should be taking turmeric. So you can go out and just buy a capsule or buy a product of turmeric. But the idea with the book is to show you how to get a therapeutic dose of a lot of these things. And there are recipes in there where you can really put a lot of herbs and spices in there. There's a very low sugar or even sugar-free, a quote, fudge recipe, where in a small piece of fudge, you can fit the equivalent of 6 or 8 capsules of spices in there. So if you're trying to take a bunch of turmeric, it can be a great way to do it. So it gives you kind of a guideline on if you're trying to take a certain herb and you know you want to take a therapeutic amount of it, these are some of the recipes and ways you can prepare it so that you can ensure that it's in your diet every day. And if you're not trying to take a certain herb, then it can just be a great way to bring a lot more spices and herbs into your diet in a thoughtful and intentional way.
Yes, it's the things you do every day that make the biggest impact on your health. The old saying, inch by inch, it's a cinch. By the yard, it's hard. So think of what you can do every day to make that, you know, good food choice, listeners out there. You know, and it's nice to throw. You know, we tend to be like one of my colleagues, Dr. Russell Mars, who wrote a great nutrition book, a little plug for Dr. Mars, Nutrition from Mars. It's a red colored book. But he talked about if we replaced the salt and pepper shakers in every diner and every greasy spoon place across America with turmeric, ginger, garlic and things like that, we'd have a different world. If we just replace, yeah. Right? Isn't that an interesting saying? And just a great thing to do. So unfortunately, we run out of time. So let's put a plug in for your website, your work, where people could reach you, where to get the book. And thank you very much for being on the program here, and leave us with some final words.
Thank you. So you can find me at bevinclare.com. That's BEVINCLARE.com. And on Facebook and Instagram at Spice Herb Wander. And you can find Spice Apothecary wherever you like to buy books. And as far as final words, I would just say, if you know all spices are good spices, definitely try to increase your spices overall. Whatever the recipe calls, that's called a guideline, and just, you know, double or triple it, and you'll be better off. So enjoy your spices.
Thanks, Bevan. I hope I see you on one of our trips and we collaborate and maybe do some herbal work together in the future. It was great meeting you virtually. I look forward to seeing you in the flesh. And listeners, thank you very much for joining us right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We're always wishing you the best of health and happiness. And till next time, stay healthy. Bye.